All right, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Newborn Libertarian. And this week, we once again have a new guest. This is your host, Kip, and I'll let my guests introduce themselves. But of course, we're going to start with our newbie. And can you introduce yourself, Franco?
Hi, my name is Franco, and I just recently became a libertarian. Well, recently being within the past 6-7 months. I became a libertarian through Christian. I started out pretty conservative. I'm Catholic, and both my parents are extremely right on the political spectrum, and so I guess it was a pretty easy step over being generation Y and being raised conservative to, you know, libertarianism.
Sweet. Thank you for joining us, Franco. And of course, I'll go ahead and let my other co-hosts introduce themselves. And just like a free-for-all, whoever can jump in first.
Christian.
Thurman.
And Tim.
And Dave.
Sweet. And this week we are going to dig into the wonderful topic, well, at least I think it's wonderful, economics. And, since I'm going to go ahead and guess, I'm really into this topic, but I'm going to go ahead and guess Christian probably is the most gung-ho about this topic. So, but Tim had the lovely idea that since probably a good portion of people might be new to this subject and might not know a lot about it, but there might be some people that know a lot about it, but decided we probably should have some questions so that, you know, people aren't lost this episode. So, Tim, since you had the great idea, maybe you want to steer this one along if you don't mind. Or am I just putting you on the spot?
Yeah, topic. Well, let's bring up a topic and questions will come.
Yeah, good point.
I mean, does everybody have a favorite school of thought in terms of economic policy?
Austrian.
Do you want to go around the table?
Yes.
All right. What school of thought most appeals to you? Thurman, start with you.
Oh, damn. No, don't start with me.
Tim, start with you.
Oh, don't start with me.
Okay, David.
Uh-oh.
David, are you there?
Oh, that's it, David. what do I want to do first? I guess this is my weak subject, honestly. It's like the nitty-gritty theory of fine economics, but I guess I would, if I had to pick, Democratic Socialist or Libertarian Socialist?
Okay. Kim?
I definitely have to go with Austrian.
Franco?
I'm going to go with the Austrian school of thought.
I'm going to take Austrians too.
Okay.
I would say, as Libertarians, I think we're all pretty Austrian.
Yeah. I was actually going to ask about, have you guys ever heard of anarchist economics?
In what form are you talking about?
Charles Fournier or Peter Kupfer? I don't know. Some stuff I read on Wikipedia. So, here it says that anarchist economics is a set of theories which seeks to outline modes of production and exchange that are not governed by coercive social institutions.
Well, there's Rothbard for you. Like Rothbard was first and foremost, I would say, the best anarchist or anarcho-capitalist philosopher, historian, and economist. So if anarchist, free from coercive entities, you know, Rothbard said police, fire, education, whatever it can be provided by the market, just like any other good or service.
And I'd like to plug in his book, The Libertarian Manifesto. He makes a really good case for it in the last few chapters.
Yes.
And what good case is that, for those who don't know?
What's the good case, Thurman? I mean, Franco.
Basically, he points out that free market work is most efficient when it's not inhibited by the government, you know, skewing the overall supply and demand, and stating, well, basically, you know, what we believe in, that the most benevolent market is the one that's dictated by the consumer, not necessarily by a single centralized force.
Yeah, I want to jump in on Franco. So along with that, you have the calculation error, which is basically when it, you can only create efficient economic production if it's dictated by supply and demand and by consumer preference. And basically when each exchange is mutually beneficial to both parties. So this is why socialist countries can't calculate. This is why they always run into shortages, whether it's in Venezuela and toilet paper, or whether it's the Soviet Union and bread. Trying to dictate prices always ends to shortages and booms and busts in terms of money and all these other things. And then if you want to get into the nitty-gritty of it, it comes down to kind of, if you go by an economist named Pareto, kind of get this theory. When two people exchange something for, because they both like the other thing that the other person has more, and they switch, both parties stand to benefit here. This is called Pareto superior, which is the optimum amount of satisfaction created in the society. Say that again. Pareto superior, which is basically when you have two parties exchanging, say, an apple and an orange for mutual benefit because each one likes what the other one has more. So this is Pareto superior. This is where society benefits when both people benefit. Pareto inferior is basically if the person with the orange steals the apple from the person with an apple. This is Pareto inferior because one party benefits where the other party obviously does not. Otherwise, they wouldn't have given up the apple. But because it was taken by force, this is an inferior transaction because only one party stands to benefit. And then you also have Pareto indeterminate, where basically if a government takes from one person and gives to another person, there's really no way you can measure the amount of lost satisfaction or increased satisfaction from the person who had it. So where it is kind of Pareto inferior, if you really think about it, because one party was stolen from, you can't really tell if both parties, like say if they build a road in exchange, you can't say if the road was really worth, especially if they never drive on that road, really worth the wealth confiscation that takes place. So basically the only kind of exchange that works in society for mutual benefit that does benefit society as a whole is Pareto superior, which is mutually beneficial voluntary exchange.
And that's also fits into always my arguments for free market is basically when I tell people with free markets and why they shouldn't have any sort of government involvement is just that when we think of money and items a lot with new economic systems is just that we think money, you know, everything is always the price that we give is equal to the item, whereas, you know, what we should really be thinking is what I have, the item that I want to get from the seller, what I have to give in exchange for that item, basically my money, I want it less than I want the item that I want to buy from the seller. And that's how I always look at things in the free market. It's just, I want to give my money because they have an item, like you said, maybe that, you know, they have an orange and I have an apple and I want to that orange more than I want this apple. And then they want my item more than they want theirs. And that's just what a free market is to me. And, you know, that's just part of my argument and that, you know, seeing as that's how a market should work, that's how economics works to me. So that's, I didn't know that was the specific name for that, but that's basically my argument for free market because that's just how it is these days where, you know, you just value something more than what you have and that's how you should exchange in a market.
Yeah, and that kind of gets into, you know, if you read Economy and State or any really basic economic treatises, profit is not just spend money on one thing and you make more money when you sell it. There's also a psychic profit involved. Psychic not as in you can move things with your mind, but psychic as in you have a pen and I have a dollar. And if I value the pen more than $1 and we exchange the pen for the dollar, I've earned a psychic profit because I value the pen more than the $1.
So it's sort of like the amount of satisfaction you get from these.
Exactly. And that goes into, you know, subjective value. But I actually have kind of a little bit prehistory here of economic thought, if you guys want to go through it, you know, before the 20th century, kind of some really prehistoric kind of principles.
Ooh. I'm in.
Go ahead, kid. So the first bullet point I have down, you know, you have Thomas Aquinas versus Duns Scotus. And Thomas Aquinas was a philosopher who basically thought there was an objective just price, and which is kind of weird because you could never really say what the just price was. As in, there's a price that buyers and sellers can morally charge without it being a sin or something like that. Like, there was some way you could objectively tell, and if it wasn't that, then your gut would tell you, and if it wasn't, you should just take control of the market, which is kind of cool. He had done SCOTUS kind of fight against it. You know, all exchanges even that are voluntary, there's no such thing as one just price. There could be lots of just prices, and the way you know it's a just price is that both parties willingly give up what they have in exchange for the other one. Another little footnote I found was Ibn Khaldun, who might be the true founder of economics, you know, before Adam Smith. They said that he really had no influences, kind of no contemporaries thinking about economics, kind of threw out the idea of the Laffer curve, which is basically, you know, if you lower taxes, you'll increase more revenue for the government because more people will keep their money within the boundaries instead of sending them offshore. So he could be called a supply side theorist, which is, again, Austrian, but kind of on its way. After those prehistoric kind of thinkers, you know, we run into mercantilism after feudalism. And mercantilism was the idea that only metal money was the source of all value.
Yeah.
Are we good? The goal of the state or political economy was to acquire as much metal money, as in gold and silver, as possible. And they encouraged protectionism. Basically high tariffs on imports to encourage exports. So mercantilists were the people that thought every single country should export so much more than it imports, because otherwise there's some kind of trade deficit and it's harmful to the country. So you see a lot of actually mercantilist thought within Trump and what he calls for, you know, protectionism, and a lot of right-wing kind of political thinkers and people in the Republican Party seem to really push for this mercantilist thought. And that kind of moves us into the classical economists who kind of pushed back against mercantilism. Adam Smith said, you know, it's not necessarily for the state to decide and for the state to dictate tariffs and exports and imports. That's for the people to decide, because basically it's not through the benevolence of the butcher or the cobbler that we have shoes. It's in their own self-interest. So their own self-interest is actually to provide for society. This is his invisible hand doctrine. Then you have, I wrote down here, Jean-Baptiste Say from France came up with Say's Law, which is basically, you know, business cycles aren't caused by a general overproduction of goods in a market or a general or a lack in aggregate demand. What he basically says is, if you overproduce in one industry, prices come down, which drives the prices up. Down here in the classical economists, we also have David Ricardo, who came up with comparative advantage, which is basically, if one country, such as the United States, is better at producing everything than, say, Nigeria is, there's still a for them to trade, because the United States might be so much better, more better than Nigeria. One good, it's better for Nigeria to produce the other good, and if they both trade, they can actually both benefit. So that runs through classical thought. From classical thought now, they kind of ran into a problem with the cost theory of value, which is basically the price you pay is determined by the cost that went into it, basically labor cost and resource cost. And this is the problem that Marx took to his logical conclusion of the labor theory of value, which basically said, you know, his whole theory of exploitation of the proletariat was that the workers are paid one wage, but then the capitalist takes a profit. So therefore, the
the worker is alienated from his wage because he's not receiving all of this. Now, there were problems with Marx's theory, and this was kind of brought to an end with marginalist revolution and the founding of the Austrian school with Karl Menger. From there, we have the neoclassical school, the market marxists. But other than that, it's kind of more anthology. Then you have the Keynesians, which basically tried to violate Say's law in every which way possible by inflating the monetary supply and trying to increase aggregates demand. But other than that, that's kind of a quick history of economic thought there, just running through some quick bullet points. Sorry if that was too fast for you. Anyone listening should really go and look these guys up and kind of, because you need to understand that the history and the way people learned about thinking and how different thinkers draw upon thinkers from the past to really know what all the different perspectives are and why they're right and why they're wrong.
Agreed. So if I may jump in, I have two questions.
Yes.
Okay. What's the difference between classical economics and neoclassical economics? And also, what's the difference between the French liberal school of economics and Austrian economics?
Okay, so the classical economists, these are your Adam Smiths, David Ricardos, these people way back when, and they kind of, you know, theory of the invisible hand, free market, this and that. The neoclassical school kind of separates itself because it kind of allows a way in for, it really comes down to methodology, because the classical economists were very good on methodology. Now, they had the labor theory of value, which led them astray and eventually led to Marxism and communism and things of that nature. The neoclassical school kind of opens the door for government intervention as it pertains to central banking. The neoclassical school would say things like, well, we need a central bank because we need them to stabilize the economy, stabilize prices and keep them from bouncing around all over the place. When in reality, the fact that prices bounce around all over the case just signals scarcity of resources or how much resources are valued. And in reality, you know, prices don't bounce around so much when you're absent a central bank. You know, Rothbard in his book, America's Great Depression, said this kind of defeated the monetary, in my opinion, defeats the monetary, the market monetarists, the Friedmanites, and the neoclassical school. When he says, you know, say every 7 years, a swarm of locusts comes and devours all the crops. Well, during the first 6 years, no one really does anything about it. But during the seventh year, they, you know, they set some honey aside and they prepare for the locust. It would be very stupid to stabilize the price of the locust industry over the remaining 6 years when they're not needed. So basically, by trying to stabilize prices, the market monetarists are sending prices in the rest of the market and flux, not allowing them to rise or fall as they need to be, all to achieve kind of a weird fetish for 2% inflation.
All right.
You know,
and the Austrian French.
Oh yes, the Austrians and the French. So the Austrians really draw upon the French classical liberal school. Basically, Friedrich Bastiat, who is a philosopher, journalist, political satirist, classical liberal. Awesome dude. If you've not read The Law by Bastiat, short little book, go read it.
It's really good.
Yeah, you talked about that last week.
Really good.
The Candlemaker's Petition, you know, he kind of came out and said, because there was all kinds of calling for, at this time, for protectionist tariffs to protect industries in France from foreign imports. And Bastiat came out and he slayed this mercantilist kind of way of thinking with the Candlemaker's Petition, which basically said it was a satirical petition written from the perspective of a candlemaker who wanted to petition the government of France for all the citizens to shut their windows and draw the blinds so the sunlight couldn't come in, so that the candlemakers would have more demand for creating light, because it was unfair that they had to compete with the sun. And Bastiat said that you know, it doesn't matter if someone can produce something better than you can, you should buy that good to be able to produce more cheaply, so that you can save and buy something in society that wasn't attainable before, because all of your time and resources were spent buying something else at an inflated or protected price.
Into. So is this where is are these the guys that created the term laissez-faire?
Yes, because laissez-faire, isn't it a French word?
Yeah.
That means hands off or something like that?
Yes, sir.
Yes, it means hands off the economy. The Austrians really kind of draw from Bastiat. He would definitely be considered subjective value. And the Austrian school started with Karl Menger, basically trying to solve the diamond water paradox, which classical economists really couldn't solve. And the classical economists thought, you know, why is it that a diamond is worth more than a glass of water? Well, obviously, you need a glass of water more than a diamond. But then with the subjective value, it depends on the time and place and how much of the one you have before.
Yeah. It all boils down to context.
Yeah, so basically, if you have lots of water, the next glass of water is not going to be demand a very high price. But if you have lots of water and diamond, the next diamond that you buy is more valuable to you than the next glass of water. But flip that around. If you're in the desert, what's a diamond going to do for you that a glass of water can't? So it depends on context and marginal value. So the most valuable thing you have will go to the first value, your first most important value for it. Say, so if you have wheat, your first harvest of wheat goes to eating. Your second harvest of wheat goes to, or it could be the other round. Your second harvest of wheat goes to planting more for the next harvest. The third harvest of wheat would go to, you know, feeding animals, because now that you have so much wheat, now you can raise animals that make your life better. Now you have butter, pork, chicken, eggs, all these other things. And maybe your last harvest of wheat is to save or to brew, create beer. Now, if you were to lose, say, the second harvest of wheat, the one that goes to planting crops, you're not just going to not plant crops anymore. What you're going to do is you're not going to brew beer and move the other two sacks of wheat that you have farther up on your scale. So it's really a marginal utility of what is the value of the next item of the same good where it comes from. And the marginalist revolution not entirely blows the classical economists out of the water, because a lot of times the original classical economists, you know, like Ricardo and Adam Smith, they came to correct conclusions, but they kind of stumbled on it from incorrect methodology. It wasn't until Karl Marx where he kind of turned everything on its head, the labor theory of value to its logical conclusion, and went full potato in terms of economics.
Yeah, Thomas Malthus was a classical economics, correct?
Yeah, and he kind of was, but even Thomas Malthus couldn't foresee that the world was going to expand, you know.
Yeah, produce so much.
Humanity expanded because of the production it was able to achieve, and Malthus couldn't foresee that. He kind of had it backwards. I think we went into this on the egalitarian episode, a little bit. So Malthus thought that overpopulation was a problem and the world could not come up with it. When in reality, it is the overproduction of food that allows for humans to sustain a larger population. It wasn't just humans were going to breed themselves out of resources, because that couldn't really happen, especially not in a market economy.
It was kind of a really close window sort of view on the problem of scarcity, in my opinion.
Yeah, like Franco, you sound so fucking sexy when you talk
to me. Yeah, I was like, hey, the sultry dulcet tones.
A lot of economists like to think that we exist within the pinnacle of human civilization and there's no way it can get better. So Marx kind of thought like that. I have a feeling that if Marx could see what capitalism had done for the world, he might have retracted his Das Kapital.
Mm-hmm. And it's also important to put in that throughout history, the problem of scarcity itself has changed. Malthus kind of stuck with the sort of a physical idea of scarcity, like food is limited, physical products, physical capital overall is limited. But later on, with a newer definition of scarcity, ideas and innovation are also factored in as capital. So,
yeah, I want to jump on that. Like, they don't really know what they don't know. And that's kind of what Friedrich Hayek said. You know, the curious task of economics is to demonstrate to men how little they know.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, we don't know what the innovations in the future will be. All we can really do is leave it up to the people who know how to innovate, to actually innovate, instead of suppressing them through incentive traps
and other things. And then one more thing about the hilarity of the classical economics. I can't remember the name of some of but some of these people, because remember the classical economists from a cost theory of value or a labor theory of value, they had some funny explanations about where money came, where value came from. Some of it, you know, it was the metal. Some of it, some people even advocated that the true value of society comes strictly from agriculture and that we should not strive for city life because life is where it was at. And
yeah, that was beautiful. I remember reading some of that.
It's just kind of funny. Like, we should all move and do subsistence farming. Kind of, you take... some of the classical economists were just kind of out of it. You know, Karl Menger and a couple other guys. But Karl Menger was really the founder of the Austrian school. And they call it the Austrian school because they were basically from Austria.
Yeah. What I also like about the Austrian school, of course I looked into a lot of the history as well, because, I mean, that's just a given when you look at it. I mean, you have to go back looking at Mises and Hayek, and you have to go to Menger and all of that. But what I liked about it is the fact that even with economics, even before then, they got slammed a lot because, you know, it's dealing with a lot of theory and actually looking at, of course, human action and having to put that into the equation world. Some of the newer economics also deals with math and, you know, having to have these absolutes and things like that. And when you're looking into, like, debt and unemployment, you know, a lot of these numbers end up falling short when you have these issues. And it's because when you're trying to get these absolutes with math and all of that, it falls short, because when you deal with human factors, humans are too complex for absolutes, and Austrian economics doesn't involve that sort of thing, you know, because you have, it's just, humans are too complex to make math such an absolute concrete thing, and that's what, you know, and it's not like there's some sort of fear of math is why Austrian economics doesn't have it in there. It's just, you know, having to factor in so much, you can't really put it on like a diagram so easily.
Ken, you bring up a really good point. I feel like we should do this more towards the beginning. Can we define what economics is specifically?
Yeah.
All right, so the fundamental problem of economics is scarcity when it comes down to it. And it's essentially the premise that we as humans have unlimited wants, whereas there's a limited amount of resources. And so basically, I guess as an example, is that, say, you have the newest phone or gadget on the market, right? And though you have, and you have this for a while, and even though it's super awesome, at some point, you're going to get tired of it, because you're going to start seeing what could be improved. And, you know, and things of that nature. So once you see what could be improved, you can't help but want more. And economics is essentially dealing with this sort of problem.
Yeah, so I want to piggyback on that. He says the more you have, the more you want. And basically, it's not because all of a sudden you want more. You've always wanted more. You just haven't had access to that more.
Exactly.
Until your needs have been covered by one thing, and the marginal value of the next thing becomes accessible to you. So if you save money because technology is improving, it's not necessarily that you all of a sudden want more. You always want more in comparison to what you have, you know, to improve your life. Mises used means and ends in terms of human action, which is the study of economics. Where basically humans have goals to satisfy a present uneasiness, and they use means to achieve those goals. So basically, once you've achieved one goal, then that present state of uneasiness is gone, and you can move on to a lesser uneasiness. Basically, you know, now that I have food, what should I do at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon? Because you know you have enough food to eat, so then other options become open to you, because you're not spending your time growing food. But to piggyback also on what Franco said on scarcity should not be taken as a fixed pie. The degree of economic satisfaction of wants shouldn't be considered as,
you know, again, this is not the peak of what we can satisfy. There are always ways that we can rearrange scarce resources to increase efficiency and productivity to satisfy more human wants. It's basically, you know, if anyone's played Minecraft, at first it's really hard to build a house, but once you have a house and you can rearrange resources in different and more complex ways, more things become accessible to you, and you grow and you grow and you grow until you have all kinds of cool cities. And I hate to simplify it down to that level, but that's kind of what it's like. So when someone says, oh, I'm poor because someone else is rich, that's not necessarily true. And if they're thinking that, most likely they're thinking about it in terms of money, which is basically just the medium of exchange, and not the way their lives have improved because productivity has increased.
Okay, let me ask you this. Oh, go ahead, Kim.
No, go ahead. I'll after you're done.
Okay, I was gonna, you know, touch on that with the scarcity. So since, you know, because of that fixed pie fallacy, does that mean that scarcity is? Could we assume that it's constantly decreasing, or it goes back and forth, I guess?
No, you can't get around scarcity, and there's always scarcity. We just become more efficient at dealing with scarcity.
Okay.
Well, because there's not a limited amount of time, and there's not an unlimited amount of, you know, there's not an unlimited amount of oil, there's not an unlimited amount of trees, and we don't live forever. So,
but there's virtually an unlimited amount of solar energy, right?
Basically, it's because, okay, so solar energy exists in a state of nature. The degree to which humans can capture that energy and transform it into a productive use is limited by the scarcity of resources required to turn the solar energy into productive use.
Basically, it's expensive.
Well, but can I? Basically, sorry, can I chime in?
Okay. Go ahead, David.
I've been kind of silent. Just kind of learning a lot. The question, I guess, first about Pareto superior. So, two parties exchange because they like what the other has more. Society benefits when both people benefit. So, I guess my first question would be, what can we do to address unequal access to the resources that it takes to trade? So, you know, in the past, in agrarian societies and hunter-gatherer societies, your life would begin by you learning the ability to provide food and shelter and basic survival needs. Or, you know, if you're looking at marginalism, the fifth bag of grain. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So, as we moved into suburban and urban societies, you start your life now learning the skills necessary to survive within a capitalist society and not necessarily to provide that fifth bag of grain. I guess it's transferred in the form of money, but when your access to the, you know, resources to trade are limited, it takes up more and more of your resources. So, like, you brought up the example the other day of you know, your hour of work being 7:25 and that being enough to provide a meal for you. Well, you're right, but, you know, if, you know, your housing takes up 4 more of your hours, if your, you know, car payment takes up 2 more of your hours, if your student loans take up another couple of hours, I mean, essentially you've got people unprepared to jump into the market because of the way the market existed before they were even born. And maybe I'm off there a little, but I guess I liked what the track he was going on with scarcity, because he brings up a good point when you talk about solar energy and our improving ability to convert, you know, our natural resources into the fifth and fourth bags of grain at a lower and lower cost. Eventually, you are moving away from the scarcity that those bags take up, and you're going to free up more of the society to pursue, you know, third, second, first bag of grain.
Well, scarcity is never really, it's not really eliminated, because the person that's born, say, into the post-industrial capitalist society today, they're born with 5 bags of grain. They don't know the struggle of having to work for the first 3 bags. You know, to take your example of the hunter-gatherer society, a meal for them didn't necessarily cost an hour, or, you know, shelter costs 4 hours per day to pay for. Their meal cost a month of tracking herds and, you know, trying to find one that they could take down without getting gored. So the post-scarcity or, you know, pre-property kind of utopia kind of idealizes the state of nature that before property and exchange came along, everything was so rosy, when in reality, we have so much production that we don't even realize that it takes human action, and it takes continuing innovation and productivity to keep driving productivity through the roof, and it keeps taking investment in people who are willing to earn a profit to create new and better ways of serving each other in society. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but I guess I would say that the person who's not really prepared to be in the market, that's because they've never, you know, say an 18-year-old, they don't have necessarily a whole lot of job skills, but what they do have is the ability to do any kind of job and not having to worry about freezing their butt off in the winter or worrying if their crop will fail or if they're going to die of the common cold.
Well, don't you think, though, that I think it might be all well and good to say, like, yes, these are the kind of functional, these are the structural ideas that make up economics, but when the perception among the public is growing in the direction that, you know, I'm not able to acquire the resources I need to get out of that fifth bag of grain, don't the rules of economics start to break down? And that's why you start to see things like social unrest, massive, you know, push for economic change, and the sort of upheaval we're living through right now.
Well, maybe, but what entitles anybody to the sixth bag of grain?
Well, it's not like a sense of entitlement. You know, a rational actor may be able to sit back and be like, yeah, of course I'm not entitled to the fruits of someone else's labor, but it almost doesn't matter if you have enough of the population that doesn't believe that, you're going to have revolution, right?
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. And the French Revolution came about on those grounds, you know, with the aristocracy and let them eat cake and this and that. I do agree that there's a public perception of inequality in this country, and I do believe that a vast majority of the inequality existing in the regulatory state to kind of privilege certain corporations at the expense of the market or to inhibit barriers to entry or to keep increasing tax rates. You know, if you want to give the poorest of the poor some kind of wage increase, the first thing you do is get rid of the income tax and then the sales tax. There's at least 30% of a minimum wage worker's money back in their pocket. If the price of everything that everyone buys goes down, the purchasing power goes up, and that increases, you know, saving amounts and investment in the future. So when we think about something limiting, scarcity limiting one's resources is basically there's not enough fruits on the tree. Where we come into kind of limiting one's resources in today's sense, you think of, you know, government telling people only certain people can take from this tree, and if you're not allowed to take the fruit from this tree, then that's too bad because we've rigged the game one way. You know, I do think Bernie Sanders is right when he says the game is rigged.
Yep.
But unfortunately, this isn't the market rigging, quote unquote, or the market determining outcomes. What we have is an oligarchic, a regulatory, really national socialist state, not a democratic socialist state. We kind of have a where the government tells people what they can and can't buy, how much tax they have to pay, the quality. Basically, even by determining safety standards and arbitrary things, they're benefiting companies that are already established in the market that can afford to abide by these standards, and not letting innovators, you know, kind of break down some kind of make some kind of cost benefit to a consumer to where they can spend less money and save on other things. So where I think the limiting of resources in today's economy, it doesn't come from the free market. It comes from a coercive entity getting in the way and telling people what they can and can't buy.
Yeah, I want to interrupt real quick because we talked a lot about Austrian economics and classic economics, but we mentioned some other ones, and I want to see if Dave, you want to jump in because you mentioned the different kind of economics you were into, if you can expand on it.
I guess I kind of brought up like libertarian democratic socialism, but again, I'm still kind of new to a lot of this. Just quickly though, so the access to resources isn't simply based on, it's not tied exclusively to scarcity, because you also have other factors at play, like the incarceration rates among the inner city. So those communities have been devastated over generations, where you know, they're not getting access to proper education, they're not getting access to
it's not just that they're not getting access to it, it's that it's being stripped away from them before they even get off the ground. You look at the disproportionate number of incarcerated people who come out of poor communities. I mean, and that's to say nothing of, like, the racist issues that go along with that, the institutionalized elements of that. So I think there are a lot more factors at play than just, you know, simply access to resources. There are things that actively limit people.
Right.
But who's doing the limiting?
I completely agree with David, and Kim brings up a great point. Who is limiting their access to these resources? Is it the market, or is it that the government is imprisoning people for victimless crimes? I mean, the police state and the war on drugs and prohibition, all it does is criminalize a certain activity and punish the people who partake in that activity, which disproportionately impacts the poor. You know, I think we're right. We can't call ourselves the land of the free when we have the highest incarceration rate in the world. If you go all the way in the anarcho-capitalist perspective, which I share, basically they say, you know, a police is best provided on the private market. And basically, some people say, well, then the police department won't have money to enforce this and this and this. And I say, yeah, that's the point. They won't have the money to enforce a kid smoking a blunt and throwing him in jail. And nobody wants to hire the racist police department, because what if the police department turns on them? The market has solutions to these kinds of problems that the state and the militarization of police and the increasing amount of regulations and escalating war on drugs, they've gotten away. And
I think that's where we're on the same side, though, libertarians and liberals. We all agree that the state's overreach when it comes to matters of criminal justice is in massive need of redress. It touches on, I forget who I was talking to, the idea of free will, basically. Sam Harris goes into it. It's too long and complicated to go into right now, but the implications it has for our criminal justice system. I mean, it's well and good to say, like, yeah, we need to change that, but up until now, people have been subjected to that through no fault of their own, and we have to try and figure out a way to right that without just, you know, neutering the government. We're all in favor of limiting that sort of, you know, needless punishment.
Right. But I think what Christian is trying to say is that even as a business owner, you know, if I was creating a product, I would want that product in as many hands as I possibly can, instead of the government telling people what they can and cannot have, if I'm stating it correct.
Yeah, and I think the libertarian and the progressive would part ways, where the libertarian would say, look, the state is causing these problems, get the state out of the way. And the progressive is less likely to say, get the state out of the way. They want the state. They don't really look at the issue of the problem, but they want to look at some kind of way to apply Tylenol to the symptoms, which is, you know, reform, which is basically just reshuffling that in the deck and deciding who, you know, which special group gets benefits now.
But
the libertarian says, hey, let's cut our losses here, because it doesn't make any sense to keep pouring resources or reforming these kinds of things. Let's just cut our losses and let the market decide. You know, I told one of my friends who is a Bernie Sanders supporter, I said, you know, what should we do about income inequality? And I told him, you know, let's get the government out of deciding winners and losers and let the market eat the rich. You know, let the rich who are rich because they produce for society stay rich. And let the hedge fund babies who make money off of, you know, protectionism and government determining the barriers to entry and licensing and all this, let them go by the wayside, because nobody wants their services when others can produce more for them. So I think the best way to end the entitled class is to separate them from the state and separate them from the coercive entity needed to sustain their monopolistic or oligarchic privilege.
Can somebody, like, give me the plan that doesn't want to destroy the state, how you fix the actual politicians you elect? Give me an actual plan of how this transparency of the government you're going to fix, like an actual physical, like, lined out plan, how you fix the actual politicians that are going to be taking control of this, something like an actual thing, not a, we're going to have transparency, nothing blanketed or vague. How are you going to fix the politicians? What rules are they're going to go by to fix this?
Right.
That, something.
Man's corruptible. You're not going to be able to get full transparency all the time.
Yeah, I know that part. You know, like, every man's corruptible. I know that. Even on a free market, you'll have a couple people that are going to be corruptible, but at least on a free market, you'll have some people that are going to be all like, hey, We would like things to be produced. We don't want your corruptible butt in here messing it up for the rest of us. So, you know, that's going to be phased out in the free market because I want my product, okay? And I don't want your crazy butt in here messing it up. But for once, I want somebody to have an actual plan to tell me how they're going to at least try to figure out how to hold these politicians to something, because we've seen how lots of people have gotten around the Constitution, finding back doors in and out of this thing to find ways around not doing anything. So I need to find a plan somehow, some way, somebody.
Well, that's the thing. You can't.
Exactly.
You cannot.
Yeah.
You cannot force transparency out of a politician, and you cannot force.
See, yeah, this is why libertarians say they want the state out of it, but that's why I'm asking from somebody who doesn't actually want to, you know, get rid of the, you know, the state. So.
Well, Thomas Jefferson thought he could, and John Adams, Hamilton, Benjamin Franklin, they could do this when they wrote the Constitution.
Yeah.
And, you know, as Lysander Spooner said, either the Constitution allowed this to happen or was powerless to stop it. You can't put, I mean, and a lot has to be said. Everyone should go listen to Tom Wood's debate with Michael Malice on whether Alexander Hamilton was a hero for liberty. And basically one of the points he said was there were three clauses that were put in the Constitution that have been so liberally interpreted, where initially the Constitution was only to have the powers enumerated to the federal government. But because of things like the Commerce Clause and the General Welfare Clause, the government and the Supreme Court, which basically, you know, the government has the power to interpret and decide whether it itself is doing the right or the wrong thing, you're always going to have an expanse of it granting itself and finding and discovering new powers for itself. It's like when the in Ferguson, when one of the police officers does something, you know, shoots a kid, you know, we don't know the particulars of that case, but for the sake of argument, when the police department investigates, it's like when the police department investigates itself and says, hey, after further review, we found we've done nothing wrong. You know, there's no way you can hold these people accountable. And, you know, not saying slavery was right, but according to the Constitution Ratification Conventions, the southern states tried to hold the federal government accountable by seceding.
Dave, can you answer this question for me? Everybody just butted in all rude.
No, it's fine. I think the answer is that technology has a big hand to play in that.
The NSA would just totally love that answer.
Yeah, I know. I sort of like, you know, I don't know.
And I just butted in all rude, too.
No, it's fine. So I think technology has a lot of the answers to that. I think dash cams, body cams, the massive outcry you're seeing on social media. I mean, we weren't even having these conversations 10 years ago. And look how far we've come already. I mean, I can't help but think it's somewhat disingenuous. And that's, I guess this is where we part also. So libertarians seem to have a lot of faith in the goodwill of businessmen. And I think the history is just literally.
Whoa, terrible. I'm going to have to stop you there. Businessmen. Do you know businessmen are people?
Well,
I guess the intent is of people who have a profit motive and can benefit.
Oh. But the businessmen people are like me.
But we're all profit. You know, we all want profit. Like as we talked about at the beginning of the show, even if it's not a monetary profit, we all want emotional profit, right? You know, when I go out and buy that new TV, I you know, that equal exchange that we were talking about, you know, I still feel like I'm benefiting.
And it's not equal exchange. It's unequal exchange. Because you value the TV more than your money, the person selling you the TV is actually buying your money with the TV and thus has an unequal valuation of what they have. So it's an inequality in value that creates these exchanges.
And I'd like to say that a libertarian doesn't necessarily put stock on the goodwill of a businessman, but more of the incentive.
And this is, yeah.
The incentive to be honest and not, you know, poison people or mislead people. I just can't even start listing all the examples of ways that people try to take advantage of that. They do anything they can think of to satisfy their bottom line. That's just.
So that,
I have two examples in response to that. The first example is like chapter 2 of Man, Economy, and State, where basically you have Robinson Crusoe and you have Friday on an island. And Friday's really good at picking berries, and Crusoe's really good at catching fish. Crusoe has two choices. He can catch more fish, and trade with Friday, and thus continue their exchange, continue the better production of berries from her, because she's better at that than he is, whereas now he can spend all his time catching more fish in exchange for berries, in opposition to trying to coerce Friday and trying to take her berries by force, which would lead to a decreased incentive to produce more berries, because if she's not getting any fish, you know, what does she care? Or he could kill Friday, take her berries, in which he's lost the productive capacity of Friday in society. Example number two is, in my business law class, my professor tried to use an example of usury, how credit card companies just want to keep you in debt and try to raise the interest rates and bankrupt you because they're just trying to screw you, which is not really true. The credit card company wants you to stay alive financially and, you know, not get into oodles and oodles of debt because they want a sustainable flow of income in exchange for money now.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what I wanted to say when you originally said something, David. For me, I look at it as a free market and entrepreneurs. It's not rational for these guys to do bad things. You know, I mean, a customer, of course, always wants the lowest prices for the highest quality. And given that in the ideal free market, as I understand it, with competition, it just wouldn't be rational for a company to be to do disingenuous things to a lot of people, to put bad quality products out there because they want to continue, like Christian just said, they want to continue to have that profit.
And also, like, it's true that sin and bad things will find you out pretty damn quickly. Ask the politicians. But, you know, I feel like this is why libertarians get a bad rap and people outside the libertarian group are good at keeping libertarians down because, you know, people say libertarians just have no heart, they have no soul, and they'll just badmouth anybody in government with no heart, they know nothing, and they just have no compassion when we say stuff like the government will indoctrinate you to make you think that we're going to say everything bad about the government just because we are heartless, that if we went to a free market, we would just be heartless to everybody, we have no compassion, when we're just saying, you know, if you see an old lady trying to walk across the street and everybody just has no regard for her and she's like, you know, about to get run over and nobody wants to help her across the street, what human being is not going to help that old lady? You know, anybody with a heart's going to do that. You know, if somebody's seeing somebody being taken advantage of monetarily, somebody's like trying to steal a person's purse or like swindle her with a deal, you're going to walk up and be like, hey, don't do that to her. You know, yeah, you'll have a couple people no matter what, they can be, you know, you'll have a few people that might do that, whether, you know, just there's always going to be bad people, but there's a lot of good people in the world. So to think that, you know, somebody's just going to try to take advantage just because they're going to have a free market or whatever the situation is, people need to start realizing that they need to be thinking of human beings as human beings and stop thinking that, you know, the government is the only people that are going to be looking out for your best interest, because the government is made out of people. The free market is made out of people.
Well, you know, I think a part of the problem.
I would agree with that. I think that's why I
mean,
oh, sorry.
Step
over there.
Yeah. Go ahead,
brother.
Sort of libertarian democratic socialism. Not for, like, all business in the hands of government. The free market certainly has a huge role to play. But to say that, like, people don't take advantage of these things, I mean, there's just...
We didn't say they don't.
Levels of obfuscation, and there are ways to cover up the negative business practices. I mean...
Should we punish the actions of a few on the many?
We should ensure that the actions of a few don't become commonplace and allowable.
Excellent, okay. David. So I want to ask you, where has all the crimes against humanity come from? Have they come from many different businessmen acting on their own in the private sector? Or have they come from governments committing mass murders, genocides, and dropping atomic bombs on populations that were already subdued?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. There are tons of examples of government and, you know, our military budget is way out of control. And there's a lot of corruption involved. On that side of things, nobody's arguing that. But I guess where we differ again a little bit is... I see government as a useful tool, and I do think that technology will increasingly help with transparency, and I think you're already seeing that, don't you think?
I also agree with
well,
you.
Well, if I might jump in here, David, because, you know, I probably would agree with you on a lot of things more than anybody else, but a problem that I see with our government is the government monopolizes on everything. They have the best of all of our technology. You know, when all these grad students... when they're, you know, when they're in college, in these graduate programs, to develop things like AI or these robots that can withstand being kicked and being pushed and stuff, the government steps in and says, hey, we're going to give you a contract and we want you to come work for us. You know, we want you to come work for DARPA and not do this on your own. And if you do this on your own, we're going to criminalize you. You know what I mean? We're going to kill you or, you know, whatever.
You're going to be jailed. Yes.
Yeah.
So
it's like drone manufacturers. You know, the government uses drones to bomb hospitals in Afghanistan and Amazon uses drones to deliver packages.
But yeah, that's what.
Do you think that sort of government abuse comes more from like the hawkish right side of things or from the left?
Both. I think it's come from both.
I think it has so far. Yeah, in a lot of ways.
If you look at the far traditional political spectrum, you know, this isn't the two-dimensional compass where you can get into libertarianism. If you go now, the left and the right in this traditional approach are both hardcore statists. So in the middle, you have your moderates. On the right end, you have fascism, which is national socialism. On the left end, you have communism, which is more or less democratic socialism. Both of these forms of government, whether it's the Nazis who are so hardcore and hawkish, basically the right or the Trumpians, they'll kill you today because they don't like you. But that's not to say that the communists haven't killed millions of people for failing to produce enough bread. So if the communist parties felt that you were slacking, you know, you go to a labor camp or a prison camp, and whether you're in Mao's Great Leap Forward or in one of Stalin's gulags, you are still a victim of government using its power towards different ends. The difference is a government doesn't stop deriving its power when people decide they don't like it. They will just work harder at coercing that money from you. If you don't like Frosted Flakes, you can still go buy Cinnamon Toast Crunch. And that's how you make your preference known. And I was going to say this earlier. One of the most extreme arguments against the completely free market was the argument of monopolization. But if you look back on it in the most lax regulatory environment, no industry could really monopolize everything. They tried to do this with the railroads in the Northeast, and they figured out they needed a cartel. But not only did they need a cartel to monopolize prices of railroads in the Northeast, they needed the government to come in and enforce their cartel.
Yeah.
To the extent, you know, someone said Hitler would have been a great stagecoach master because of the size and scope of government. He became what he was today. And to play off on David's point on technology, I agree. I think technology has allowed to reduce the size and scope of government, and I think it will continue to do that. And I think that's a good thing. Whether you're back in feudalism, where you have basically the need for government or a state or a king, is basically to protect you from outlaws and bandits. Well, when people got gunpowder and they got guns, not only could they protect themselves from bandits, but they could also protect themselves from oppressive governments. And you bring in body cameras, cell phone cameras, all these other things. Social media was an effective tool in stopping what would have been an invasion of Syria earlier, because Obama drew a red line in the sand and people got wind of it, passed around social media, basically put that down. So I agree with David where he says technology is going to be the road to productivity and the road to the best kind of society we can hope for. But it's also going to be the road to minimizing the power of the state in your lives.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, of course, I'll point out again, I'm still on the path of minarchy here. So, you know, even though I'm asking all these questions, David, I'm still semi with you there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
sure.
I'm on the path of smallest government ever. And I would really like them to be transparent, but I would love for technology to be what helps us. And I see in the ways that would help. It's just, you know, if there definitely was a way, because I think like Congress made a huge mistake with giving the president so much power. And of course, I always rail against all the judicial power that there is to just interpret some of the law that there is, that there's just so much power. But I think technology can play a major part, but there is, of course, that issue with some of the manipulation that goes with the developing of technology and just the things that they can do. But I think it can help us, but like I said, just keeping the government accountable is going to be the hardest part in how we do that.
I think
maybe there's a misperception here too. So I said this last time. I don't care how big the government, as long as it's effective. So you know, if it needs to be a hammer, it'll be a hammer. If it needs to become a wrench, yeah. Like you said, I think technology will help a lot with that, and we're not, you know, quite there yet. But well, I mean, I guess when you talk about limiting the government and minimizing it, what would that look like prior to us, you know?
Wait, what was the question again?
Because of the, you know, capabilities of technology, great, let's downsize it.
Well, what was the question? Sorry.
So, if we can minimize the government by allowing technology to, like, fill those roles.
Well, I wouldn't say limit the government by utilizing technology. I'm just saying limiting the government in general.
What does that look like in your opinion, then?
Well, basically, what a government was created to exist, and Bastiat goes into this in the law, the government is created to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from aggressors. Now, once the government starts infringing on your rights and your life and your liberty and property, how can the government simultaneously protect your property while infringing on your property? It becomes a contradiction in and of itself, and at that point, there's no stopping the snowball.
Like, I mean, how many of these people do we need? Like, do we really need this many people? Do we really need this huge, huge machine?
Well, exactly. And, you know, when the sequester happened, right, so the first people laid off were unnecessary government workers. Okay, well, if in Stapleton went into this, what is an unnecessary government employer? Why are you stealing people's money or taxing people's money away or taking away their purchasing power to pay for something that's unnecessary? That in and of itself should make you stop and think, huh, maybe we don't need all of this government.
And did they actually term it unnecessary government?
Oh, no, you can't get fired if you work for the government.
No, well, were they actually termed unnecessary?
Yeah, they were deemed unnecessary.
What? So if you term it yourself unnecessary, that's just, what? Can you at least find another term for it to pass it off on us? Gosh.
You can try to limit government. And this is where I agree technology is going to take it all the way, because a piece of paper or a constitution can't enforce itself. And when people talk about checks and balances between the three forms of government, if you think three branches of government are going to try to limit each other and limit the growth of the powers of the other branches, you don't know a lot about trees. Yeah. They're all part of the same tree. And what's good for one branch is good for all the branches.
Speaking of trees, because I've seen this on Facebook, it's really ridiculous that I just have to say something. More solar panels is not going to cause trees and other grasses to start doing less photosynthesis. It's really ridiculous. Go on.
People are saying that.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, my God. It's a science teacher who said this. And he also said solar panels possibly cause cancer. It's ridiculous.
Franco raised his hand a long time ago.
Another thing I'd like to add is that not only can the Constitution not enforce itself, but like Kim said, there's a huge problem with interpretation because it can't interpret itself either. Like, there's been very, very liberal interpretation of the Constitution, and I don't think even technology can really save us from that because the Constitution and the law is ultimately interpreted by man.
Yeah, it's the only reason I rail about the Constitution is because that's supposedly what they use. I love how, like, they will go, this is in the Constitution, and then all of a sudden, like, they'll do something else, and you know, it'll be obvious they don't want to use the Constitution, but then as soon as you bring something up and it is constitutional, suddenly the Constitution is wonderful again. I'm like, make up your mind.
Exactly, and that, I mean, just to draw a comparison, the non-aggression axiom is just so much more simple than a constitution. It's very clear cut.
So to bring it back around, that was an excellent tangent, David.
Sorry.
It was fun, and I really do love it, and I think it's really easy to follow this podcast for listeners, but I think maybe constitution or legal theory or some kind of non-aggression episode might be in order to continue this discussion. But if we want to gear it back towards economics and scarcity, if that's okay with you guys.
Yep.
We're about like an hour in.
We got like 30 minutes to keep it, uniform with all the other ones. Does anyone have anything else on economics they want to get into?
I love.
Do you guys know much? Do you know much about the field of libertarian socialism, and what do you think about it?
Okay, so libertarian socialism kind of comes from Chomsky. Kind of made that famous, Noam Chomsky. And Noam Chomsky is really, really good on being anti-war, and war is just ridiculous in every sense of the word. And there's a difference between self-defense and aggressive war, which is very important. But Chomsky even says himself that he doesn't understand the rules to economics. So, Chomsky once said about anarcho-capitalists, I think he said that, he says, cool, I'm a banana octopus, but when he says libertarian socialist, I'm kind of like, well, cool, I'm a banana octopus. So, kind of contradicts himself. So a libertarian would say, no one has the right to determine what to do with my life or property, but a socialist says, someone else has the right to determine what to do with my life and property because it's left to the aggregate or the collective or the community. And democratic socialists say, well, someone else has a claim to your property, but we're just going to vote on whose property we steal first. So it's just subject to, because the majority says so. As opposed to like a Soviet-style dictatorship where Stalin decides what we say so. In a democratic socialist kind of economy, 51% decide what they do.
I don't like democracy. Straight up.
Yeah.
I agree.
It's just mob rule.
It is mob rule, but from the same perspective, democracy is better than one person deciding what to do, because at least there's pushback. When you have a monarchy or a dictatorship, it's just with one person deciding what you can and can't do. I say, would you rather get punched in the face or punched in the arm? Well, I'll take a punch in the arm, but I'd rather not be punched at all. But Hans Hermann Hoppe has a book called Democracy: The God That Failed.
I think it'd be good to discuss the fundamental differences between capitalism and socialism, because I find that a lot of people don't even know those.
And that a lot of people think that we're in some sort of like some sort of free market that's a socialist free market.
No,
wow.
You could make the argument that there are parts of our system now, which, whether you think it's good or bad, that, Social Security is clearly a socialist type system.
Yeah, but think this is a free market that we're in. They like what we're in now. They think this is actually a free market. Like this is
No, we're in an oligarchy.
Yeah, right? They think this is a free market.
We're in an oligarchy, and our economy more resembles Nazism and National Socialism and Fascism than it does any sort of semblance of a free market. Hitler said, we're socialists. We hate the free market, and kind of where the government tells you what you can and can't do, who you can and can't hire, what the regulations are, and this and that. But the fundamental difference in socialism is so many people, especially on the right wing, they think that socialism is just a wealth transfer. So they think socialism is just we take money from one group and we give it to another group. That's kind of a part of it. True socialism is a centrally planned economy where the means of and ownership and private production are in the hands of the collective or the state. And so that's when people, and especially, liberals and progressives want to cut out Scandinavian countries as socialist paradises. Well, they're really free market economies, and they're more free than the United States is, and they don't spend so much money on the military. They don't put much regulation on business, and they don't protect their own industries, but they kind of do. Not to the extent the United States does in throwing their weight around in the UN and imposing sanctions on other countries. So really, maybe Sweden has a better social safety net, which is, it's still kind of socialism, but it's the least damaging kind of socialism than it is trying to run absolutely every facet of an economy, which is really what socialism truly is. So if Bernie Sanders says we need to be more like Sweden, I say I agree. We need to be more libertarian like Sweden is.
For any of our listeners who are wondering what America is, a lot of people say we're a democracy, republic, whatever, blah, blah, blah. We are a socialist oligarchy, straight up. The only time your votes mean anything is state policies. And not even that sometimes.
Yeah. Even the military is just one big social welfare program.
I honestly
get a lot of flack from it, but
I sort of agree with that.
Yeah.
I think we should move away from that. I think I do reject centralized state ownership and control of the economy. I think most rational liberals would.
Except Bernie Sanders.
But well, they don't.
He's not for centralized state ownership.
No, no, he wants more worker co-ops, which is basically term for we need to. This is basically bourgeois versus proletariat kind of vernacular. Where he wants to remove the power to decide what the business does from away from the business owners and the shareholders and management into the hands of the working class. That's not just simple, hey, here's a little stipend so you don't starve.
I'm a follower of his. I'm not catching that from him. Can you?
It's like on his website. it's there.
He's talking about centralizing these. I mean,
it's like
yes.
Oh, it's like his little biography.
Yeah, like there's actually an episode where Jason goes into like his entire like it's on his website and his biography, and he goes through like that and I'll have to send you the link. He like goes through the entire thing, and it's, yep, he basically has that on there, like literally. It's a.
I'm gonna have to look that up because I'd be surprised if that were true. Most of what I've heard from him is talk about coming down hard on Wall Street and basically the crew that created the 2008 event. I never hear him talk about can you give an example of what he?
I'm on his website right now and I don't see anything about centralizing anything.
Yeah, I'm gonna say I don't believe that unless I see some kind of link or something. I've never heard any kind of talk like that from him. And I've been following him for the last 5 years. Honestly, back in 2000 when he made that big speech in front of Congress, I was like, this guy's different. I really like him. So I've been following him since then.
Okay, so I'll read off the I'm on the issues page on his website right now.
Oh, it's not his website. It was the Democratic Socialist website of some party or... it was not exactly his website.
Yeah, not specifically.
It was like the definition of what democratic socialist is per some website.
Hold on, let me see if I can find it.
Well, this just to give you some background, he's not going to come out and say it. Because
yeah. Why would he do that?
A professional young person is going to come. What? This is a man who spent his vacation and has his honeymoon in the Soviet Union.
Why would he do that? It would just not make any sense.
Let's talk about
let me see if
democratic
I can find
socialism.
I think I found it. Hold on. All right. Got it. I will send it to you. Anyway, somebody talk on so there isn't like radio silence. And, yeah, I'm like, there's the radio silence.
Well, I think a lot of the appeal with Bernie Sanders is that we have a lot of people our age who are just upset that the things that were promised to us are just clearly not happening for us. You know, with just the growing amount of kids who our age still live at home. They're not getting these high-paying jobs that they're so-called promised just by, going through the motions, going through college, and all this stuff. And, I think they see Bernie and they
yourself,
see...
Dude.
And they see this guy. They see this guy is kind of just he has an answer. Well, without kind of looking at whether the answer and the repercussions of his answers, it sounds attractive and they cling on to it.
Dude, I research like crazy, man. I'm like, if you're gonna give me a platform and it's called democratic socialism, I want to know what democratic socialism is. You don't pitch to me anything. I will find out what it is.
Sanders.senate.gov, worker-owned businesses, Monday, June 2nd, 2014.
Yeah, that's a specific site, yeah. Now,
where is that?
Creating employee ownership. See what Bernie doesn't understand, and this is what he's coming from, is he thinks that there's two kinds of people in a company. There's the management who pockets all the profit, and there's the worker who does all the work. And somehow the management and the owners are not the employees, when in reality they are, because they all benefit from this company. So for someone to say that worker-owned companies, he doesn't realize that all companies are worker-owned. The difference is that, whether it's to attract more votes, he panders to the majority of the people in the business, which are, are the worker bees. And he wants... This is socialism at its core, it's redistributing the means of production from the capitalist class, or the people who take on risk to create new business ventures, and giving it and putting it in the hands of people who will vote for him. That's what democratic socialism is.
What was the site again?
Sanders.Senate.gov.
Thank you.
I mean, you just look at some of his tweets.
You're self-employed.
You just look at some of his tweets. Young people should be able to get an education regardless of income. That's really appealing to young people because they want to go to college for free. Well,
isn't that to teach a man to fish?
No, that's giving the man the fish, because the good is the education.
Yeah, and the reason I sent the Jason video, because he actually goes through and explains that exact thing point by point. And he goes from Bernie Sanders' site to what does he point out? I can't play the video, of course, but I can't remember exactly. But he goes to a different document from a different country that advocated for this, and it didn't work out so well for them.
It's probably Greece.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't agree that free college is giving the man a fish, because he, at the end, he has a service that's going to produce or allow him to get goods.
How do you know that?
Yeah, how do you know that?
Well, assuming that it's a legitimate trade, you know, such as somebody going to get a degree in engineering or one of the others, you know, a STEM.
Well, there has to be a demand for the product that you're learning to produce.
Well, there's always going to be a demand for doctors and engineers.
So, right, but clearly not everyone's supposed to be a doctor and engineer.
With all the federal expansion and the money that they funnel into college the past 30 years, what amount of degrees have increased the most? Has it been, you know, percentage-wise growth in doctorate or engineering degrees, or has it been liberal arts and philosophy kind of degrees? It's been the latter, because kids, you know, they say they want a free education so they have a job in the workplace, but what they really want is someone to pay for their years of experience in a piece of paper that they think magically tells employers they know how to produce something. That's the problem already. So many kids are coming out of school with degrees and said, well, I went to college and no one is going to hire me, or no one's giving me the kind of job I want. Well, what does that tell you about the degree itself?
All right.
But I like what David said about taking on the 1% and taking on the people that caused the financial crisis. And this can kind of lead us into business cycle theory. Basically, I would agree. Someone needs to. But I call it more or less, you know, the Wall Street Bank, because all of these big banks, they're really only one bank. You know, we have central planning in the most nefarious place in the economy that's absolutely possible. And that is the central planning on the money supply and price in the economy. So did anyone have anything to say or look anything up about, you know, business cycles or central banking or money and credit they want to share?
I'm still working through this gigantic tome here about...
Well, while she's looking, I'll just mention, I think... You know, a lot of times I look at Bernie Sanders and I say, you know, what a lot of he's saying is, it's the anger is directed. I agree with the problem. I don't agree with the solution.
Yeah, so if you look at Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders, they both are pointing the fingers at the right people. Now, Bernie won't go so far to point the finger at the Federal Reserve, but... they point the fingers at the right people, but the difference is Ron Paul says, hey, let's end central banking, let's get all this and that out of there. The last thing Bernie Sanders wants to do is get rid of the central bank, because that is the only place that is going to be able to pay for all of these programs he wants to put in. He's not going to be able to tax it out of the people. They'll move their money somewhere else. They'll leave the country. They'll do something. They won't vote for him. But if he can kind of hide it through borrowing and the inflation tax, which consequently hurts the poor most of all, That's his enabler. That's the Federal Reserve and central banking, and the ability to sell bonds to continually borrow from basically a borrower with unlimited pockets, because they can just create money. That's what he's going to use, or what he would like to use, to create all these programs, just like the Federal Reserve has bought every single wartime bond, basically enabled every single defense contract through the Bush, Clinton, Bush, and Reagan years. Whether it's military spending or gigantic social and quote-unquote investment infrastructure, the Federal Reserve is going to be the enabler for all of that, because if people think they're going to be taxed, they're not going to vote for you. It doesn't matter whose side that you say they're on.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but if Sanders does do that, won't that just cause more inflation?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, clearly we see that people have no problem getting taxed. I mean, I think otherwise there wouldn't be a whole debate whether tax is theft or not. I mean, as a libertarian, we see it. Yeah, that, there's a big problem there.
They don't think it's going to be then that's taxed. You know, Sanders, one of the things he says is, we want a tax on speculation in the market. And Jason Stapleton does an excellent job of explaining this. If you trade stocks in the stock market, you are a speculator. That doesn't necessarily apply to the 1%. You know, Franco's a speculator because he trades stocks on the stock market, and he's pretty good at it. But here's the thing. One, in an inflationary environment and you're poor and you can't save, or you're middle class and you're scrapping a little bit of money together, if you sit on that money to save, that money will depreciate in value because of inflation. Now, where does that incentivize you go? Oh, yeah.
The stock market.
The stock market and the casino. Basically, the inflationary environment has turned everyone into speculators and Wall Street gamblers at some form or another. And to put a tax on speculation is basically to put a tax on the savings of nearly 70% of the country.
What do decreased savings do?
Yeah, decreased savings.
Decrease innovation. No. An investment, proper investment.
Oh, wow.
It's a good way, which is a good lead in into Austrian business cycle theory.
Ooh.
Oh, well.
Just hit me with the left jab, baby. Mind blown.
Well, I guess we have a Democratic Socialist of America website.
Mm-hmm. Oh. That's what I was just on.
Oh, okay. We need Bernie. So, Democratic Socialists believe that both the economy and society should be run democratically to meet human needs. Not... Oh. Okay.
So, well, the whole idea is that even if they did go at it with the best of intentions, the calculation problem would prove inferior to free market capitalism and actually solving the problem of providing for human needs. But, that's beside the point. I know all the libertarians out there listening. If you don't listen to Tom Woods, go listen to Tom Woods. If you haven't gone to Mises.org, go to Mises.org. But if you're just coming to this for the first time and you're wondering, what the heck is Austrian economics and why are we, as libertarians, kind of so infatuated with this? I think it might be a good time to get into the business cycle theory.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So why don't we go around and everyone tell us kind of what they know about business cycle theories, and then Franco and I can fill in the blanks from there. And again, Franco and I are not trained PhDs in economics. Franco is majoring in economics. I study it because I'm that kind of nerd. But other than that, if you really want the intricate details, go to Mises.org. And start watching. But for those of you who are listening and kind of want to hear the quick run through, we can answer any kind of questions you have.
Like, what in the world do you want me to even tell you?
I don't even know.
I'm actually, what's it called? Because I wanted to talk about, you just said that, I wanted to talk about the Mises boot camp, and I watched it. It's 6 episodes, and I think it is a really good introduction for Austrian economics. How it's divided, you know, 1, they talk about human action, 2, markets and prices, 3, the entrepreneur, 4, intervention, 5, money, and 6 is the business cycle. And for me, that put everything together.
Yeah.
And they're 30-minute episodes, you know, so it's pretty lengthy. But honestly, if you can stick through it or you just want to watch one each day, I think it's beautiful.
Okay, so I'm going to take a quick run through of those 6 episodes because I recently just watched them too to freshen up.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I did too. So, not going to lie.
You start with human action and subjective value and marginal utility. Where basically, every person subconsciously ranks everything that they want on a scale. And it's not, there's no scale that proves, like, you know, the first thing on your list is twice as good as the second thing on your list. All you know is it's above it at some shape or form. And every single resource you have at your disposal is ranked in an order. Now, moving on to the entrepreneur. The entrepreneur's job is to kind of risk what they have, risk their resources, and by betting on, they can produce something that consumers in the future will demand. And the means through which entrepreneurs acquire the capital to start new ventures is through credit markets, because no one has $1 million sitting in their pocket, most likely. What they have to do, they go to the bank. Now, when interest rates are high, that tells people what they produce better produce very quickly, because they need to be able to pay this loan back. When interest rates are low, they say, you know, maybe we can produce in a more research-heavy or long-term kind of project. And the interest rate, how high or low it is kind of depend on the supply of the money. And the supply of the money in the bank is dependent on consumer time preferences. So when the interest rates are high, it means there's not a lot of money in the bank, which means consumers want to spend money today. When interest rates are low, it means consumers are putting off their spending today because they want more tomorrow. And that low interest rate tells business owners and entrepreneurs to forecast that they should take the money now and invest in long-term solutions just to fulfill consumer preferences. Now, can anyone kind of tell me where the monkey wrench is thrown in, as opposed to what could possibly interfere with these time preferences?
I have an idea.
Oh, Tim.
Nope, this is Dave.
Yeah, I was about to say, it's Dave.
Dave.
Meanie.
I wasn't looking. I was looking at pizza.
Yes. One possible monkey wrench in terms of signaling to producers to continue producing. So I looked recently at the issue of vegetarianism or veganism. So if you're an advocate for veganism and you want to kind of, if you want to send a signal to the producer to stop buying meat or animal products, you can withhold your purchase from them. But producers and purchase, the manager of the grocery store who decides what to order doesn't tally all of the unpurchased incidents. They only tally, so your one instance where you buy, a pound of ground beef speaks 100 times louder to that manager than 100 times of you not going into the store and not buying that. Is that kind of what you're asking?
Entrepreneurs track inventory, and so they do count the unsold product. Basically, when they do inventory at the end of every day, they're counting the amount of goods that were unsold, and maybe they need to lower the price. But
that's not exactly, that doesn't exactly skew what they need to do versus what is actually, that doesn't necessarily make them do something that isn't what they need to do. That just encourages them to follow the,
maybe lower the price on what they've already have,
which is good.
Yeah, which is the market solution to that. But the monkey wrench really comes in where it basically, when you're signaling to producers to start creating something, which basically what an entrepreneur does is when he takes on risk is he borrows a lot of money and he uses that money to pay workers before he even collects a profit. He uses that money for his new venture to pay workers, to buy resources, and to use his expertise to buy capital goods and combine them all together into something down the road.
The monkey wrench basically skews the forecast for when and where he should distribute his capital.
And where and what kind of projects he should invest in. Because there could be normally very competent entrepreneurs who are good at forecasting who, if they see a lowering of the interest rate, think, oh, now it's time to invest in long-term projects. But the reality, what you have when a central bank lowers interest rates arbitrarily by, influencing reserve requirements or setting their own rediscount rate or basically just printing money, they create money in the system that wasn't created there by savings. And because the savings is what shows the entrepreneur the consumer time preference.
And I'd like to backtrack and say that the aforementioned monkey wrench is in fact referring to interest rates set by the central bank.
Yeah, so basically,
okay.
When a central entity sets the price of interest that doesn't reflect the amount of savings in the bank, the lower interest rate tells investors and entrepreneurs to invest in long-term projects when the reality of the interest rate would be much higher when consumers want to spend money now.
Or short-term projects.
So what you have is, in the new credit markets, you create a boom in certain long-term industries where consumers are still, you know, still showing their original time preference for short-term goods. And what happens is, because all this new money flows into one industry, it makes it look like it's a lot of profit. But in reality, it's just inflation. So what happens is, these entrepreneurs are spending all this money on resources and bidding up prices from other places. And everyone else who receives the money from the bid up prices, the money then circulates out farther and farther into the economy. Now, eventually, when people receive all this new money, they still bid up prices on consumer goods now. Because remember, they haven't changed their time preference. They've just received a lot of new money. So they're bidding up prices as they consume goods at their normal short-term consumption preference rate. And eventually what happens is, because some capital goods can't be redirected into the long-term goods because the time preferences haven't changed, it's just an artificial interest rate setting. Some capital goods that are not convertible just get consumed, because that's not where the investors are told to invest their money. So eventually, when original time preferences and the new money liquidates into the rest of the market, one, the long-term projects are shown to be unsustainable because that's not what people want. And two, because capital wasn't allocated or invested in or maintained efficiently, in the short-term good markets, there's not enough goods anymore to go around. And so you have a bust in both places. The Austrian business cycle theory says basically it's not the market crash that's the problem. It's the boom that started it in the first place when you try to influence interest rates. The crash that happens is what has to happen for the market to liquidate and all for the inflation to go where it needs to go, and so people can reestablish and invest and save for the future.
And if I can jump in, I just want to say, you know, it's never rational to think short term.
Always a bad idea. You want to think short and long term. Well, don't you want to think short and long term? Because I think a lot of the issues with a lot of the economic theory, like, some people would think long term, but never the short term. Because if you have a chance to have something that would help you right now, at least, and then as well as long term, you want to see if you can do that. But sometimes you have theories that would help you long term, but not short term. And then you have theories that would help you short term, but not long term.
In business cycles, there are short-term and long-term goals and objectives, but when the interest rate is overall skewed, what that causes is, I guess, a greater degree of overlooking other periods of time which are probably more beneficial to them as a whole. Like, for example, a lot of the intermediate goals get overlooked when overall interest rates are skewed. Basically, what it is there's too much emphasis being put. I mean, like we said, companies are profit driven. When the interest rate is, you know, being manipulated, then the long term goals just look more profitable
because there's more money.
Yeah,
because there's more money coming in, but it's not consumer demand, it's inflation.
Yeah, and I mean, Thurman brings up a good point. Short-term investment is it's oftentimes not a good idea, but to put things into the scope of short-term versus long-term, we have to remember that there are also intermediate goals, which may be more long-term than short-term goals, or more short-term than long-term goals.
And then there's the fact, you know, some people say in a deflationary environment, no one would buy anything because they'd wait for prices to fall. But Tom Woods brought up a great point. He says, well, what are you going to do, wait on your deathbed to buy an iPod? I mean, there comes a point where you want the thing today.
Exactly. That's just speculation.
So it's the market is such an intricate latticework of individual consumer preferences interacting with each other over the course of hours and days and weeks, that to come in with such a heavy hand and skew something so fundamental, really the most important price in the market, the interest rate, the price of money, is really, really sloppy. And now there's two ways you can do this. You can try to do what the Federal Reserve did in the late 1920s, and when they realized that the market interest rates needed to rise, they could just keep printing the money basically in putting earmuffs over the economy's ears and saying, la, 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 don't listen to market signals. When in reality, that just made the eventual crash worse. And then you obviously had the, you know, Hoover and FDR doing what they did to prolong the Depression, namely Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, make-work programs, and pouring milk down the drain to increase the price of milk because supposedly that would help the farmers. It's just, and then, or you could do what Germany did, is you could just keep printing the money indefinitely, just keep the spending boom going, and cause hyperinflation where the cost to burn the money for warmth is more efficient than buying gas.
But what increasing aggregate demand does, it completely ignores the concept of the original inflation that's taking place. And I think that's where Austrian business cycle really differs from other business cycle theories. It's that we put more emphasis on the problem of the initial inflation, as opposed to monetarists, which believe that aggregate demand at the end can be manipulated in order to stimulate a market economy.
Does that make sense for everybody?
Crystal clear, yep. Baby.
I hope so.
Yes, and we are past the hour and a half mark.
Sweet. Should we wrap up?
Yes. This old lady's got a bedtime.
Hey, I want to say, though, I'm really happy that David is on, because I like being challenged and having a different viewpoint, because when things are an echo chamber, it's really kind of boring. So I'm happy that David is still willing to come back on, and I hope he's willing to come back on next time too.
What? Why do you think I say David's the man? I like him.
David's the man.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I'm sitting here reading the Wikipedia page for the Austrian School of Thought as well.
Thanks for keeping us on our toes.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll do my best. Thanks for.
We still have a slice of input too.
It's a lot of stuff I haven't necessarily thought about and couldn't articulate as well as I'd like to. So, yeah, we're all learning.
Oh well, that's why you beef up and come back.
Yep.
Hey, let's plug this episode on Jason's podcast. Let's do it.
I'm just remembering all the dumb things I've said in the last hour and a half.
Hey guys, we should do an episode on our court system, or like peniology.
Ooh, good one.
Oh man, well I've already voiced some frustrations I have about it, so I'm pretty sure I'll have plenty to say about that.
Word, peniology would be a very good one.
We're doing feminism later this week, though, right? Or
I'm down.
That'd be a good one.
We haven't done feminism, and we've been meaning to get to it. We should get to feminism next.
All right, let's do it.
Right. That I can do.
Am I going to have allies on that front?
Hmm?
I said, am I going to have allies on that front?
Yes, I am a feminist.
Cool. I've got no knowledge of it, so
I'm indifferent.
I mean, I think everyone's, unless you're completely ignorant, is in some way a feminist.
Right.
Yeah,
I agree.
I think people are like, finally, an episode where Christian doesn't have any opinion on. Maybe, you know, it'll be an episode where everybody else is heard.
I'm sorry, guys. Yeah, next week I'll take my medicine.
No, I'm teasing you. I'm just teasing you.
Okay. I like it when you tease me, Kim.
Giggity.
But she doesn't like it when I tease her. She's not into that.
No, I'm into your girlfriend.
Oh, hey, no, only me.
Hey, you know, you're not a true friend of mine until I've hit on your girlfriend.
Ooh. Jeez, well, I guess it's her friendship or your girlfriend.
Anyway, I guess this is the moment where I plug the Twitter and everything. So,
let them have cake and eat it too.
Yeah. Yeah,
don't hit on my girlfriend. She might actually flirt back.
Oh, perfect. So can I get her number after I hit stop? Because I don't want everybody else to have her
video
number.
Video chat for that one, right?
All right, yeah. So everybody else, if you want to hit us up, you should hit us up. You should definitely find us on iTunes and rate the podcast. I prefer 5 stars, but you can give us whatever stars. But either way, let us know what we're doing well, what we're not doing well. Just either way, give us good feedback. Definitely promote the show, because we would love more listeners. If you want to email us, you can email us at newbornlibertarian@gmail.com. Hit us up on Twitter @newbornliberty, and find the Facebook group. Just search out Newborn Libertarian and just shout us out. We'd like to hear from you guys. And I guess sometime this week we'll be putting out another episode on feminism. And then until then, this has been your host, Kim, along with my guest. Go ahead and shout out.
Franco.
Thurman.
Tim.
Dave.
And Christian.
All right, guys, until next time.